This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a killer cop goes on trial in Chicago, claiming he shot Laquan McDonald 16 times because that's what police are trained to do. And the U.S. corporate media lies about Venezuela every day, but Facebook shuts down the page of one of the only publications that tells the truth about that country.
But first, much of the corporate media is talking about the New York Times op-ed piece, supposedly written by a high-ranking staffer in the Trump administration, who claims to be working to undermine the president's policies. The writer claims to be part of a resistance and wishes to remain anonymous. We call Dr. Gerald Horn, the professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, to see what he thinks about Mr. Anonymous.
Point number one on the broader front, it represents, as have many recent events have tended to do, a real split in the upper levels of the U.S. ruling elite, which, of course, is no secret. In a sense, as I look at it, it's almost like karma, because if you look at Afghanistan, for example, pre-U.S. CIA intervention in 1978, it was had a fairly progressive movement there, not least that was ruling. But now there seems to be a choice between the Islamic State and Taliban in terms of who's going to be next in power. And likewise, in the United States right now, because of the success of the U.S. ruling elite in battering the left, it's really circumscribed political space and forces, progressive forces, at least in their own minds, to align with one or another faction of the U.S. ruling elite, neither of which have proven themselves capable of rescuing the masses of people from this crisis. Likewise, this op-ed piece is reminiscent of Grenada, in a sense, in terms of how the split in the rulers of Grenada in 1983 set the stage for the catastrophic U.S. intervention of October 1983.
Are you saying that demonstrations of purported disarray in the White House might be setting the stage for some kind of intervention, one that would not necessarily come from the Congress?
Well, as you know, in the national security establishment of the U.S. ruling elite, there is a lot of discontent with Mr. Trump. And in fact, to cut to the chase, one of the suspects in terms of who wrote this op-ed is Mr. Huntsman, the U.S. ambassador to Moscow, who feels that Mr. Trump's policy towards Moscow, and of course, this is the point of view of a good deal of the U.S. ruling elite, they feel that Mr. Trump's policies toward Moscow are misguided. And if you look at that column, that's one of the points that he focused on, how people like Mr. Huntsman, presumably, are carrying out a policy not congruent with the aims and wishes of one Donald J. Trump. And what happens when you have an abrupt change of regime in the United States of America, it oftentimes happens in a way that provides deniability, such as what happened in November 1963, for example, or what happened in April 1865, for example. So that's the second point, which is that with regard to this disarray at the highest level of the U.S. ruling elite, in particular the discontent within the national security establishment, that's something to keep an eye on. Then the next point, of course, now we're going to go into murky waters, is that some of the language, as many of the commentators have pointed out, this use of the term lodestar and cold comfort, for example, is right from the rhetorical playbook of Vice President Michael Pence. Now, there are those who suggest that actually Huntsman was sly enough to realize that. That's why he inserted that to direct attention towards one Michael J. Pence. I would also say that I can't say that I'm that upset with the fact that they're squabbling within the highest ranks of the U.S. President League. Maybe if they're fighting each other, they'll have less time and energy to fight us, for example. So this idea that has been floated by Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, that top leaders of the Trump team be subjected to a polygraph, a lie detector, I think that's a wonderful idea. It's a marvelous idea, because I think that at this point, the progressive movement in this country is certainly not, and certainly worldwide, is not harmed by this kind of internecine conflict at the highest levels of the U.S. ruling class.
Well, certainly we're looking at a piece of governmental destabilization. And what organization is better with more experience at destabilization than the U.S. so-called intelligence community?
Well, that's what I mean by karma. I mean, that's what I mean by chickens coming home to roost. That is to say, they practice these dark arts all around the world, as noted in Afghanistan, in Grenada. In fact, if you look at a number of once progressive parties, I'm thinking of what used to be Southern Yemen, the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen, you might recall that before Yemen began to fall apart, which has now led to this Saudi and U.S. bloody intervention, you had a socialist party ruling in Aden. And just as in Grenada and just as in Afghanistan, the U.S. intelligence services got the leaders to go towards each other's throats. And that's basically what happened. And so now you see chickens coming home to roost, and U.S. leaders are going at each other's throats. And there's a kind of poetic justice about that, I have to confess.
Yes, in the real world, outside of the rhetoric of Russiagate, Russia and China have moved much, much closer to each other than historically they have ever been under these rather aggressive postures taken by first the Obama administration and, despite all the rhetoric, also by the Trump administration.
Well, that's a very intriguing point that you're raising, because it ties into the prior point. What's happening is that there's a split in the U.S. ruling elite as to how to confront the major powers. The Democratic Party faction, as symbolized by Hillary Rodham Clinton, the idea was to confront Russia first, to continue allying with Berlin and France and the North Atlantic bloc, and then after Russia is sufficiently compliant, then going after China. Whereas Mr. Trump is taking a different approach, which is to conciliate with Moscow and go after China first. So it's Russia first versus China first. And so what's happening now, because of the split, they're basically doing both, I mean, which is loony, because the United States is perhaps overestimating its strength to go after these two powers simultaneously. And so what's happening is that it's putting the United States in a very disadvantageous position, but there's so much arrogance in Washington and New York, I'm not sure if that's sufficiently recognized. Perhaps it will be recognized in a few days when hundreds of thousands of troops engage in these military maneuvers on the Russia-China border east of the Ural Mountains, which means that it's not obligatory for Moscow to invite Western Europeans to this, that is to say, congruent with international agreements. And Russia and China are becoming as close as lips and teeth. And if you recall, Henry Kissinger, who still carries some weight within the U.S. ruling elite, even though he's 95 years old, when he effectuated the entente with China some four and a half odd decades ago, his premise was that the United States should be allied with one or the other, and certainly not allow the two to come together, with the United States being on the receiving end of their enmity. But that's fundamentally what's happening. At the same time, you might have noticed that Michael Pompeo, the U.S. Secretary of State, was in South Asia just the other day in New Delhi. And the idea, congruent with the jargon change from Asia-Pacific to Indo-Pacific, is to enlist New Delhi in this anti-China confrontation. That's not going very well either, even though relations between India and China have not been ideal, to put it mildly, given the 1962 conflict between them. And the situation with regard to New Delhi has been worsened by Mr. Trump, who, as you know, it's well known that he makes fun of Prime Minister Modi and his accent. And he's made disparaging comments about India, just like he's made disparaging comments about other nations that are comprised of those who cannot fairly be defined as white. And it's that kind of erratic behavior that's really upsetting the national security establishment, because from the point of view of the confront Russia first faction or the confront China first faction, they all recognize they'll need New Delhi on board. And Mr. Trump is fundamentally hampering that, and he's going to perhaps worsen relations with New Delhi sooner rather than later, because the U.S. is going to insist that India comply with tightened and heightened sanctions against Iran, even though Iran is a major oil supplier to India. At the same time, because of this two-faced policy towards Russia, there's going to be pressure on New Delhi to not continue buying arms purchases or not continue its arms purchases from Moscow, even though the relationship between Moscow and Delhi stretches back to 1947. It was one of the signal aspects of the Cold War. India was probably Moscow's chief non-communist ally. And so this incoherence and confusion of U.S. foreign policy, which is symbolized by the erratic behavior of Mr. Trump, is upsetting the national security establishment. They would like to see the ouster of Mr. Trump sooner rather than later, which is why you had that talk in the op-ed about invoking the 25th Amendment, which, of course, if successful, would lead to Mike Pence becoming the occupant of the Oval Office, which is one of the reasons why suspicions lingered that he might have been behind that op-ed. But in any case, once again, there's a kind of chickens coming home to roost aspect, because what the United States visited upon Afghanistan and Grenada and southern Yemen, amongst other nations, that is to say, fomenting discord at the highest levels of society, is now afflicting the U.S. ruling elite.
Beyond the confusion in U.S. foreign policy, there are certain facts, huge facts, that have emerged in the world. And one of them is that China now has approximately 25% bigger economy than the United States when measured by purchasing power parity, which is the preferred gauge of economic vigor. And the military power that the United States confronts, Russia, has not been made to budge in Syria, where it drew a line against U.S. intervention.
With regard to Russia, I would suggest to your readers and listeners that they look at Mr. Putin's speech on March 1st, 2018. You can find it on YouTube. There are many versions of it. The executive summary is presented by Canadian Broadcasting, where he signaled the introduction of these new weapons that Moscow has developed, which is causing many a sleepless night in Washington. You are correct to suggest that Washington's policy in Syria is also incoherent. On the one hand, we are told repeatedly that there is a so-called war on terror, But at the same time, in Idlib province, which is the headquarters of thousands, if not tens of thousands, of religious zealots, you would think that Washington was eager to oust, you find that Washington is threatening Moscow and Tehran, suggesting that if they support the Damascus-based regime of President al-Assad in helping to eliminate this nest of zealots, that Washington will retaliate. Now, already, Moscow sources are suggesting that another false flag operation is in motion, whereby the zealots will launch a chemical attack that then will be blamed on Moscow, Tehran, and Damascus, which will then necessitate, from Washington's point of view, a muscular intervention. If that happens, it might also tend to put Turkey in a very difficult spot. You might have noted that President Erdogan met with the leaders of Iran and Russia in Tehran just the other day, and Mr. Erdogan also suggested restraint because he says that he is concerned about refugees pouring into Turkey, and that is why he's calling for a restraint, he says. But at the same time, as you know, Mr. Trump has slapped sanctions on Turkey. It's helped to drive the Turkish lira into the ditch, helping to foment a kind of economic crisis in Turkey. There's no love lost between Ankara and Washington. So I'm not sure how Turkey is going to respond in the next 24 to 48 to 72 hours if Syrians and their Iranian and Russian allies move into Idlib province with a certain kind of muscularity. Now, with regard to China, I noticed two aspects in the press of late. One, of course, is the summit with African leaders, which was reported in this country as being China luring African nations into a debt trap. That's the line, which was rebutted by African leaders themselves. But as you know, the North Atlantic countries are accustomed to treating Africa with condescension. And so they don't necessarily take seriously what African leaders say, because from their point of view, the Africans cannot defend themselves. And of course, they may have reason to know, since they were the perpetrators of the unlimited African slave trade. But in any case, that China-African summit was one more indication of the declining hegemony of the United States of America. And then the other aspect are the stories that are now coming out of Western China about reports that suggest that thousands upon thousands upon thousands of Muslims in Western China or being deprived of their religious liberties and religious rights. I think that you can expect those kinds of stories to proliferate in coming weeks and months, perhaps years, because there's going to be a need for the North Atlantic countries to put pressure on China. And in that regard, you might have noted that in the September 8th, 2018, Wall Street Journal, there's a story about Mr. Trump contemplating putting tariffs on over $200 billion of Chinese exports to the United States, and how in that regard he's trying to enlist those who he's also helped to tax, I'm speaking of the Germans in particular, to enlist the German-led European Union into this anti-China cabal. Now, that's going to be rather difficult at best, because as the neoconservative never-Trumper Max Boot pointed out in the Washington Post just a few days ago, while the United States is racked with this internal conflict at the top, the world is moving on. And so you see Germany moving closer to Russia, and it's going to be very interesting to see if Chancellor Merkel forgets what she has learned over the past year, which is that the United States is an unreliable ally, that Mr. Trump is erratic, and signing on to an anti-China cabal with Mr. Trump, when just of late, within the last 6 to 7 months, there was talk about how Mr. Trump wanted regime change in Berlin. Recall that his ambassador in Berlin, Richard Grenell, when he arrived in Berlin, started talking about organizing forces to the right of Chancellor Merkel. You might have noted that in Eastern Germany of late, there have been these pro-Nazi demonstrations under the slogan, "We are the people," which, recall, was the slogan in 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down. Interestingly enough, it's now the chant of the neo-Nazis in East Germany, interestingly enough, intriguingly enough. And so it's going to be a real test for Chancellor Merkel and her comrades in Berlin as to whether or not they're going to take a flyer on Mr. Trump's invitation to join the anti-China cabal, when Mr. Trump himself has been talking about ousting the present leadership in Berlin. And it's, once again, it's that kind of incoherent, erratic policy that has the national security establishment upset. It seems as if the Trump faction feels that U.S. hegemony and domination is a gift from God, and nothing they can do will wreck U.S. hegemony and domination. And of course, it's that kind of arrogance that has been the downfall of empires and powers stretching back eons.
Meanwhile, Anonymous seems to say that he's working along with others towards a foreign policy that will stabilize U.S. imperialism.
Well, yes. That's one of the reasons why it's suspected that when they do the lie detector test, which I hope that they pursue, they will find that the culprit, that Anonymous, is perhaps someone like John Huntsman, the ambassador in Moscow, or some other member of the national security establishment. But I think from the point of view of the U.S. ruling class, it's very difficult when you're dealing with major powers like Moscow to pursue that kind of two-faced policy, because you may be able to get away with that, if you like, in dealing with smaller countries and dealing with Grenada in 1983, for example. But I'm not sure if that'll work with regard to Moscow in 2018.
Dr. Gerald Horn's latest book is titled The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism.
One of the best political journals on Latin America, written in English, is Venezuela Analysis, which keeps track of the ups and downs of the socialist movement in that South American country. Last month, the long algorithmic arm of Facebook reached out to temporarily shut down the Venezuela Analysis page for no announced reason. We spoke with Venezuela Analysis reporter Jeanette Charles.
We are the only English language multimedia platform that daily and regularly provides analysis and on-the-ground reporting from Venezuela and about the Bolivarian process. And about the short-term Facebook shutdown of our page, it was very ambiguous reasons that we were given about the page being removed from Facebook for almost a day. For us, we understand this as part of a larger campaign to essentially limit the amount of information that people based in the United States have access to from the left, from radical positions, and from anti-imperialist movements, particularly from Venezuela and around the world.
Many of us in the United States complain daily about the oligarchs' control over the means of communications, but in Latin America, it's no better.
Yeah, essentially, in the case of Venezuela and across Latin America and the Caribbean, one of the trends that we've seen in the last two decades is an emergent grassroots-led as well as progressive state-led media. And this has really helped to shape and challenge the U.S. war machine, U.S. imperialism, and U.S. corporate media narratives that are joined by other allies across Europe, Canada, and the global north. And essentially, you know, oligarchies across Latin America and the Caribbean that have very strong ties to the United States are very threatened by this, because what we're seeing in Latin America and the Caribbean, and particularly places like Venezuela, is the capacity, the willingness, and the experience to actually achieve a media narrative that goes against imperialism, that is rooted in people's histories, that is rooted in an alternative world and a world in which many worlds can fit and in which people's right to life with dignity is at the forefront of these struggles and of these messages.
And yet we see the oligarchs' media taking the lead in driving the Workers' Party from power in Brazil. And the capitalists still have a great deal of control over media in Venezuela.
Yeah, you're correct. Venezuela, there's still a very large presence of both corporate and right-wing media. The Venezuelan constitution and Venezuelan media rights allow for a diverse array of opinions with regard to media coverage. And so really, while oftentimes the oligarchy says that they are being censored by the Bolivarian state, really they have ample airwaves to send out any sort of message that they'd like, which is why you saw in 2014, 2016, 2017 with the Guarimba violence, open declarations by right-wing opposition leaders such as Leopoldo López calling for violence on the streets of Venezuela. And this was challenged in many ways by the Bolivarian state in ways by calling on people to in peace, to, you know, remain calm, to also, you know, respect each other's lives. So you kind of see a difference in what is being propagated by the right wing and by their media allies, such as CNN, Globovision, and other outlets, versus what state-led media was trying to do at the time, which was trying to pacify the situation and trying to prevent the loss of lives. And then at a grassroots media level, people being openly critical about the right-wing opposition and also being very encouraging of the state line, which was trying to prevent any sort of intervention or any sort of violence being taken.
Even with the attempted assassination last month of Venezuelan President Maduro, the corporate media in the United States insisted on framing the event as the alleged assassination attempt, as if it might have been staged.
And this is one of the things that we actually criticized at Venezuela Analysis, which was the corporate media's essential ridicule of the assassination attempt. One of the last pieces that we published before our Facebook page was taken down criticized very heavily the role that corporate media had taken in attacking not only President Nicolas Maduro, but also essentially stating what you just mentioned, which was that the Venezuelan government had staged the assassination attempt or that it actually did not occur. And so we know that the corporate media lies. We know that the corporate media distorts. We know that the corporate media serves larger purposes and is not about democratic information diffusion or democratic information dissemination, but rather about a bigger picture of U.S. imperialism and a U.S. occupation machine. And so, yeah, essentially, with the assassination attempt, it's been really interesting because the Venezuelan government has responded by simply carrying out a very thorough investigation, which has direct ties to the United States and to sources in Colombia in relationship to a very violent sector within the Venezuelan opposition and oligarchy.
In the corporate media, the problems that Venezuela is having economically are all laid to the Socialist Party, to the Bolivarian process. And there's very little mention of the economic war that the United States has been waging on Venezuela for more than a decade.
With Venezuela Analysis, we are also part of a growing international solidarity campaign that is calling to end U.S. and Canadian sanctions against Venezuela. I encourage everyone to check out more information about this campaign. Economic sanctions are an act of warfare and in many ways are a preliminary step towards active military intervention and warfare as we steadily see the increase in U.S. threats to militarily intervene in Venezuela or to encourage that other states such as Brazil and Colombia do so on the region's behalf. And essentially, people can find information about the campaign and our call to action at the Alliance for Global Justice website and also on Venezuela Analysis website. You can also email endvenezuelasanctions@gmail.com and check out the Facebook page called End Venezuela Sanctions. You can also contact us at Venezuela Analysis at editor@venezuelanalysis.com. A lot of the different organizations, movements, anti-war activists who make up this campaign have participated in different solidarity brigades, delegations, and exchanges with Venezuelan grassroots movements, civil society, and state institutions, and have found that one of the greatest challenges to Venezuela's growing revolutionary process and just the country's sustainability as a whole are the detrimental impacts of these economic sanctions. And it's important to mention that economic sanctions are illegal under the United Nations Charter, as well as the Organization of American States Charter, which the United States is a signatory in both of these institutions, as is Canada. So we are urging everyone from your different organizations, communities, places of work, etc., to sign on to this campaign and to take action and to denounce these sanctions so that we may be able to lift them in solidarity with the Venezuelan people.
That was Jeanette Charles of the political journal Venezuela Analysis.
The trial of white former Chicago cop Jason Van Dyke began last week. Back in 2014, Van Dyke fired 16 bullets into the body of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, a killing that was captured on video, but the tape was kept hidden for more than a year. When the video was finally released, it caused a political crisis for Mayor Rahm Emanuel and his top cops and prosecutors. Paul Street is an historian, an author, and political activist from Chicago. He's keeping a close watch on the trial of the killer cop.
4 years later, and that's a statement in and of itself, that's kind of astonishing that it took 4 years for this guy to go to trial. His name is Jason Van Dyke, and how he gets to plead not guilty in and of itself is quite astonishing, because we have a video. And it was the night of October 20th, 2014, and there's a video that all your listeners and anybody else, all they got to do is plug in the guy's name, Laquan McDonald, and you can just watch this man, Jason Van Dyke, pump 16 bullets, one after another. You can see the dead body of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald laying on the ground, jerking with each new shot, smoke rising up out of his body. You can see before the shooting that he was walking away from the police officer in question, Jason Van Dyke. Rahm Emanuel and his state's attorney, Alvarez, delayed the release. They did everything they could to stop the release of that incredibly provocative video. It ended up there was a sort of neat rogue researcher, reporter, and civil rights activist here in Chicago that forced its release. Alvarez lost her job. As I recall, the Chicago police commissioner lost his job. Emanuel's approval ratings took a big hit, and people talked about him being a one-term mayor. 4 years later, and this guy has the audacity to plead not guilty, even though you can look right at the tape, to a murder charge. These guys practically always get off. I mean, what is it? It's about, they're batting about, 998 cops are when they shoot young black people. What makes this case particularly sort of remarkable is that the video that's out there for everybody to see, and just the incredible open savagery of the killing. And the Chicago Tribune allowed Jason Van Dyke to even attempt to try and sort of pollute the jury pool and gaslight the jury pool, and sort of help encourage amnesia amongst the jury pool and in the public by giving him a nice little interview in which he tearfully claimed that, the last thing you ever want to do is shoot your gun. You try and avoid shooting your gun anytime you can. This is something you don't want to do on the job. And his wife says that it's been filmed on the local media station saying that we're just petrified that he's going to spend the rest of his life in jail. I say, well, say it 16 times. Say you're petrified 6 times. And, of course, all of this behavior by Jason Van Dyke, the one truth in his not guilty plea, the one thing that actually sort of resonates with truth, is when he says, I was doing as I was trained and as I was socialized by the Chicago Police Department. And there's about two things in the Obama administration that they did that I will give some praise to. One of them is the Iran nuclear deal, and the other one is the Justice Department investigations. They were fairly decent. Ferguson and the Chicago one at the very end of the Obama administration, just as he's walking out the door. But there's a decent report on the Chicago Police Department that was forced by the uproar over the Laquan McDonald shooting here in Chicago. The documents, to some extent, Van Dyke is kind of right. I mean, there's just a long history of hideous, racist, trigger-happy shootings in Chicago, as in other cities. It's particularly bad in Chicago.
I just wanted to remind you, Paul, that in 2007 and 2011, the U.S. intelligence community, as they call themselves, concluded that Iran had no nuclear project, no nuclear program. So even Obama's Iran deal was based on a U.S. lie. But back to Chicago. During the preliminary investigation of Laquan McDonald's killing by Jason Van Dyke, a host of his fellow officers backed up his lying testimony with lies of their own, but they were not fired en masse.
Oh, yeah, well, that's just standard operating procedure. You know, that's the blue code, and I imagine that's operative across New York City, Boston, Detroit, and everywhere else. Yeah, that's definitely how they do it. And it was mostly white cops. It wasn't all white cops. Just going completely nuts. And actually, in a black middle-class neighborhood called Auburn Gresham, they thought they had some teenager in a backyard somewhere. And you can just see that, like, 18 Chicago police cars sweeping in and jumping into people's yards, guns drawn. I mean, they think it's the Wild West or something. It's just madness. I'm one of the few white people that actually have gone in and sort of monitored police behavior. I sort of used to do that in my urban league job. And it really is just astonishing. It's just like three or four black guys, kids, converging on a street corner and talking to each other, thereby triggering a violation of a gang ordinance. And you just see these cops just ride up on them and just leap out of their cars and put them up against fences. And this is an institutional culture across urban police departments. It's particularly graphic in Chicago, which, of course, is an extremely segregated, savagely segregated. And you see this very violent and aggressive police behavior, particularly in gentrification zones, particularly in areas where real estate interests are coming in. And these sort of community areas that show up in the census as momentarily integrated. And the only reason they show up in the numbers as integrated is because they're transitioning from having formerly been 90% black to being like 75% white because of gentrification and moving people out. It's kind of disgusting. You can correlate the violent incidents with gentrification to some extent.
And of course, gentrification is well underway in Chicago, which has seen a big drop in its overall black population. But now Mayor Rahm Emanuel is on his way out. He announced that he's not running anymore, just as the Laquan Davis trial was beginning. But he didn't attribute it to the deteriorating relations between him and the black community, mostly revolving around the police.
Yeah, well, you know, and by the way, on the gentrification on the South Side, one of the agents of gentrification right now is former President Barack Obama, whose Obama Presidential Center is eating up a bunch of cherished public green space and in turn is triggering real estate developments in its near vicinity that is sort of simultaneously pissing off community-based black South Siders. The ex-president is sort of coming back and reestablishing his irritating relationship with black Chicago that people forgot about, the distance that there always was between Obama and the black South Side, even as he was claiming it. You know, I imagine Rambo just sees the writing on the wall. He's been serving and protecting white gentrification, real estate interests, financial interests in the city with tax increment financing deals that disproportionately benefit well-heeled investor interests, many of whom don't live in Chicago themselves, but live in the Winnetkas and the Lake Forests and the elite 90% white 0.1% suburbs of the city. And that's his real constituency and his real clientele. He served them very well. Now it's probably time to go cash in, or I don't know, maybe he wants to throw his hat in the ring for the presidency or something like that. That whole fiasco seems pretty wide open right now. They don't know who they want to run against Trump in 2020, assuming they still have him around to run against. I suspect the Democrats want to keep him around in order to run against him.
And moving from police crimes against black folks in Chicago to the crimes that have been committed against the planet Earth. In your current article in Counterpunch, you take issue with those who say that it is humanity's fickleness and greed that has led to the ecological disaster. And you say that a particular class of humanity is at fault, the ruling class, the people with the money.
Yeah, well, there's so many issues that matter to us on the left. I tend to think sometimes that the climate issue, and which is one aspect, it's the vanguard issue of an environmental, absolute environmental catastrophe that now earth scientists say legitimately raises the question of extinction, human extinction, that is. I mean, let's forget all the other species that are already going extinct. And I often think that it's probably the biggest issue of our or any time, because nothing else is going to matter. All the things that we care about aren't going to matter if we don't have a livable planet, so we're just going to be arguing about the more equitable slicing out of a poison pie. And people experience a lot of this climate crisis right now as weather, and the weather is extraordinary, and we set new records every year, and we have these simply incredible rains, these simply incredible droughts and mudslides and tornadoes, hurricanes of greater intensity than we've ever seen, and they have all kinds of collateral damage, but it really hits the fan. And is in some parts of the world already starting to hit the fan. When the climate is too hot for people to cool themselves in the way that human life requires, when we're not going to have enough water to drink, when we're not going to have the productivity to grow the food we need. And that's happening right now. And it is just astonishing how little attention it gets in the media. The Trump fest, the endless Trump news cycle. And Trump himself is very much in the vanguard of the assault on livable ecology. I mean, the assault on livable ecology was bipartisan and is rooted ultimately in capitalism. Trump's in the vanguard of it. I think it's the main threat that Trump poses. You know, when Noam Chomsky says that there's a World War III threat under Trump, I don't see that. I don't see Trump in Russia. I mean, what, they're going to blow up the world? I mean, I don't think Hillary Clinton would have blown up the world with Russia. I don't think the ruling class wants to necessarily blow up the world nuclear war, but they're perfectly happy to blow up livable ecology. I mean, essentially, we're witnessing the greenhouse gassing to death of life on Earth. Okay, that's a crime that will make the Nazis, okay, even the Nazis look like small-time criminals. And they did finally get some attention, big attention, in the New York Times Magazine story recently by Nathaniel Rich, and it had this fascinating title. The title was Losing Earth, which the minute I saw that title, I was like, well, who told you or human beings that Earth was their property, that they could have it? It reminded me of, you know, we lost China or we lost Vietnam, right? I mean, it's incredibly anthrocentric statement in the first place, like it's our property, like we own it, as if we're not part of Earth ourselves. But the whole blame in Rich's essay, and it's wonderful, it's good. It reports this crisis that's going on in ways that you rarely see anymore, that nobody even hears about, with Trump this, Trump that, the endless Trump circus. So he's good on recounting what's going on, but then he just completely blows up any comprehension by just blaming human nature, human beings. Well, you know, I'm sorry. That's a bit much. The species has been around for 100,000 years, and it's only been since, let's say, 1600 that we've had a kind of system, a class rule system, a growth and accumulation system of class rule called capitalism, where the society is just wired to rapaciously enclose and commodify, and wired from the top down, not the species, but the species under the command of capital, to enclose and commodify and exploit human labor power, which is part of nature, the land, the raw material, and all of that, all in the interest of profit. And that's really a capitalist crime more than anything else. You know, it's not humanity as a whole that created textile factories in Manchester in the 19th century, or auto factories in Detroit in the 20th century, or the Dakota Access Pipeline in the 21st century, or, you know, the Foxconn factories in Shenzhen today in the 21st century. Humanity as a whole didn't create them. Capital did. Capitalism is doing that. And it's the capitalists who drive this destruction of livable ecology. Marx had a hint of this and an understanding of it even in the mid-19th century. It really took off, and the alteration of Earth systems under the command of capital really took off in ways that scientists can show altered the Earth systems after World War II and in that great boom from the 45 to the 70s. And that's very important to note, because it's not just neoliberal capitalism. I mean, it was capitalism operating at its so-called best from 45 on that really pushed the climate and other aspects of livable ecology sort of past the tipping point. So you think you want to blame human beings in general because they can't plan for the future. It's not really true. Most of human experience has not been subject to the relentless, soulless logic of what Marx called the egotistical calculation, right, of the bottom line quarterly earnings profits. So,
and that period was the period when the United States controlled half of the world's production. It was sitting on top of the world. So if there is a ruling class that is to blame, it is primarily the U.S. ruling class.
Yeah, and the U.S. ruling class with a particular institution called ExxonMobil that was in full possession of research on the greenhouse effect. The ExxonMobil scientists calculated and projected data on the impact of carbon emissions in the 1970s and the 1980s. And ExxonMobil, headed at some point for many years by Trump's former Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, consciously buried and sunk their own climate scientist findings on the consequences of the excessive extraction and burning a fossil fuel. I mean, that's the crime of the century. It's not the crime of the millennium. The tobacco company did that with cigarettes, and we all have relatives, and we can all tell stories about people we know who experienced lung cancer and emphysema and all that. But now we're talking about the whole damn species, every single human being on Earth, and our chances for a decent future. And the U.S. is very much in the vanguard of that, and pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords and all that. We're like a rogue state. We are a rogue state on the climate issue. I mean, Trump's made it worse. But Obama was no environmental savior at all. He had an all of the above energy policy. He opened up all kinds of offshore drilling. But Trump's worse in this regard. I think this is the main way that Trump is really, really bad. And no one talks about it. The two things. I think the open embrace of let's get a hold of every fossil fuel we can and burn it and burn the planet to the ground. That and the kind of ethnocultural, racial, scapegoating, fascist-like rhetoric about immigrants and African-Americans and Muslims. I think that those are the things that it's amazing right now with this latest thing with Trump, with this letter that came out, this anonymous letter. It's just not being, these things aren't being talked about. We're talking about other things other than the main ways that Trump ought to be discussed.
And by that anonymous letter, you're speaking of the person whose article was published in the New York Times, who claims to be a high official in the White House, who is actively sabotaging Trump and Trump's policies.
Funny things about the letter is that it's really quite pleased, as much of the ruling class has been pleased. It's an establishment Republican. It's an establishment neoliberal Republican. They're quite pleased with the tax cuts. They're quite pleased with a lot of aspects of Trump policy, you know. And so we're all focused on the letter now, in which the Democrats are just frothing about and having great fun with. The person appears to have no issues whatsoever with the racism, the longstanding racism, I mean the open, explicit, fascist-like racism of Trump. And it doesn't have any issue with the ecocide that we've just been talking about, the accelerated ecocide. The ecocide's been ongoing. It's bipartisan, but it's accelerated under Trump. That doesn't appear to be an issue. So it's just more reason not to talk about the main things. It's more of a way not to talk about the main things that ought to be of concern about the current public enemy number one, which to me is always the sitting U.S. president.
And let's point out that the Democrats have put up no real fight against not only Trump's humongous military budget, but his horrible overall budget.
Oh, it's just amazing to hear the Democrats denounce this guy. I don't disagree on some levels as a authoritarian and as a psychopath and a malignant narcissist. I mean, that's kind of part of the character structure of a U.S. president. But he just takes it to levels that are unprecedented. And then vote for him to have unprecedented new military spending dollars and surveillance power. It's like, okay, you just called this guy somewhat accurately a sociopathic, malignant, narcissist toddler, just sort of hell on wheels, out of control. And then you just voted him a record-setting Pentagon budget and new spying capacity. It's just kind of ludicrous.
Paul Street's latest book is titled, They Rule, the 1% versus Democracy.
Ramona Africa, the longtime spokesperson for the Move family, is in failing health. The Move family has suffered horribly at the hands of the Philadelphia police. Many Move members remain in prison for alleged involvement in the death of a cop in 1978, and 11 family members were killed, including 5 children, when police bombed their house in 1985. Ramona Africa was one of the 2 people that survived the inferno. Ralph Pointer is a human rights activist, the husband of the late people's lawyer and political prisoner Lynn Stewart. Pointer says the movement must embrace Ramona Africa during her health crisis.
Yes, we have to be at her side because, as in Momia's book that he entitled The Long Distance Revolutionary, Ramona Africa exemplifies that. And all of the Africas and John Africa's positions have proven to be prophetic as well as considerate of the whole human race and of animals. But we must support Ramona and we must prove friendship, but we must also understand that Ramona is in a position that all of us or any of us could be in tomorrow. That is illness without health care necessary. Single-payer health care that we allowed Obama to fluff aside and say, I know I promised it, but it's off the table. And so here Ramona is suffering, and I hope that through her situation, we will all get a better understanding of the health rules and regulations. And one of the main regulations is if you don't have money, you're in trouble. And if you don't have money, they will expel you from the hospital before you're ready to go. If you need assisted care in terms of therapy, you can't get that unless you're willing to give up your home, because they will take whatever property that you have. And so we're holding an event in New York, October 7th, the Lynn Stewart Organization and others, Raymond Nat Turner, and the Friends of the Africas, meaning the Friends of the Earth. The Friends of People should be able to raise funds necessary for Ramona to have decent health care.
Ramona Africa, of course, has been a spokesperson for the Move organization for years, but she and Move have acted in solidarity with many other strugglers for freedom in the United States and around the world.
Yes, they have acted not only for people, but they were the first that I heard of a serious organization dealing with animal rights. And I remember way back, and I would not put a date on it, in the 60s when we were talking about human rights and civil rights and the law, they were going to the zoo to protest treatment of animals in the zoo. And my first reaction was, Jesus, we got enough trouble, you know, people first, and et cetera. And now I look back at it, and I'm saying, yeah, they were ahead of us. They fought for the rights of this planet. We talk about the Green Party, and we make disparaging remarks about tree huggers. Well, before the Green Party, there was the Africas. They were talking about sustainable living. And so we see a soldier for the planet is ill, and we must step forward to do something, but we must also emulate the Africas by saying, yes, we're going to support Ramona, but yes, we must understand that every living thing needs support, and there is a way to do it. Gradual, single-payer health care is not the answer to health, but it's a good step in the right direction, and we always have to remember the Africans talked about natural healing, things that you could do for yourself so as to best prevent being in the position that we all will be in as we age. And so, yes, we have to look at the total picture of Ramona, the work that she has done, and understand the work that they have contributed, their contribution to all of us when they talked about being more natural. And I remember listening to a discussion of the medical advantages of a lemon. And, you know, it's things that I had never thought of. And eating properly, the advantages of eating raw food. And, you know, like to avoid processed food. I mean, they are a dictionary of what we must do to survive in the planet. And one of our leaders in every movement, they stepped forward to support Lynn Stewart. And, of course, their legendary support of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And so we support Ramona directly, and we support the movement by emulating what they have been doing for a long, long time.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.